This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Long Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know with Teresa Mitchell.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud media sponsor of Organicology, the Northwest's largest gathering of the organic food trade. Study the organic industry and shape the future of sustainable eating. February 7th through 9th at the Hilton, 921 Southwest 6th Avenue in Portland. Again, that's Organicology, February 7th through 9th. More information can be found at kboo.fm/organic2013.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Yellow Pages, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New mobile applications available for iPhone and Android. For more information, you can visit pdxgyp.com.
This is Press Watch, a weekly counter-propaganda and left opinion program. Here on your people-supported free radio station, KBOO Portland, I'm Teresa Mitchell. Join me for a brief peek behind the video veil of Monopoly media manipulation and an examination of the news you're not supposed to know. First headlines from RIA Novosti. The demand for gas masks has almost tripled in Israel in January amid concerns about the safety of the Syrian chemical weapons stockpile, according to Ynet. The Israel Postal Service, charged with free distribution of non-conventional warfare protection equipment, said the number of Israelis who decided to update their gas masks and ABC kits, let's see, that stands for Atomic, Biological, and Chemical Kits, have tripled in the past month. The Postal Service said the number of daily orders has spiked from an average of 200 a day to 500 a day. And that from RIA Novosti by way of rian.ru, if you want to look that up. And from The Guardian, Syria's ambassador to Lebanon has said Damascus has the option to respond to what it says was an Israeli airstrike on a research center on the outskirts of the Syrian capital on Wednesday. Syria could take a surprise decision to respond to the aggression of the Israeli warplanes, according to Mr. Ali Abdul Karim Ali. And he told a Hezbollah-run news website that. He also said Syria is engaged in defending its sovereignty and its land. He said that without spelling out what the response might entail. Syrian state television said the country's military command had confirmed a scientific research center northwest of Damascus had been struck at dawn on Wednesday, causing damage. Two people were killed and five wounded in the attack on the site, it said, which was engaged in raising the level of resistance and self-defense. Now, you may have heard about this already, and I thought I'd just present the British press on it. U.S. officials quoted in the New York Times said that they believed the target was a convoy carrying sophisticated anti-aircraft weaponry, and Israel had notified Washington of the attack. Syria and Israel have fought several wars, and in 2007, Israeli jets bombed a suspected Syrian nuclear site without retaliation. Departing from that text, after looking at the aerial photographs, I personally severely doubt that that was actually any sort of useful nuclear facility. Who knows what was stored there, but there definitely wasn't anything powerful going on because it didn't have a good power supply. Didn't have any power supply, come think of it. Returning to the article, Lebanese media claimed a dozen IDF fighter planes had flown, that's the Israeli Defense Force, had flown sorties over Lebanon's airspace from Tuesday afternoon until Wednesday morning. A Lebanese army statement said four Israeli planes entered Lebanese airspace at 4:30 p.m. on Tuesday. They were replaced 4 hours later by another group of planes, which overflew southern Lebanon until 2 a.m. and the third mission took over, finally leaving at 7:55 a.m. on Wednesday morning. IDF said it had no comment. Russia said it was concerned about reports of the air attack. So, things are cooking in the Middle East. Israel evidently attacking the Lebanese-Syrian border. More information from The Guardian. If this information is confirmed, then we are dealing with unprovoked attacks on targets in the territory of a sovereign country, which blatantly violates the UN Charter and is unacceptable no matter the motives to justify it. That's a quote from the Russian Foreign Ministry. They made that statement today. Moscow has been trying to shield the Syrian president, Bashar al-Assad, from international pressure to end the civil war, which has killed an estimated 60,000 people. It has repeatedly spoken against any foreign interference in Syria, especially military action. Israel has previously publicly warned that it would take military action to prevent the Syrian regime's chemical weapons from falling into the hands of Hezbollah in Lebanon or global jihadists fighting inside Syria. Israeli military intelligence is said to be monitoring the area around the clock via satellite for possible convoys carrying weapons. So a pretty tense situation there, and you can read the rest of that article at theguardian.co.uk. Here in the U.S., this article by Elizabeth Reut, published in The Ecologist, in the midst of the U.S. domestic energy boom, livestock on farms near oil and gas drilling operations nationwide have been quietly falling sick and dying. While scientists have yet to isolate cause and effect, many suspect chemicals used in drilling and hydrofracking operations are poisoning animals through the air, water, or soil. Last year, Michelle Bamberger, an Ithaca, New York veterinarian, and Robert Oswald, a professor of molecular medicine at Cornell's College of Veterinary Medicine, published the first and only peer-reviewed report to suggest a link between fracking and illness in food animals. The authors compiled 24 case studies of farmers in six shale gas states whose livestock experienced neurological, reproductive, and acute gastrointestinal problems after being exposed, either accidentally or incidentally, to fracking chemicals in the water or air. The article, published in New Solutions, a journal of environmental and occupational health policy, describes how scores of animals died over the course of several years. So, what's that beef taste like these days? This from the International Business Times. According to stories collected by undercover reporters working for Asia Press, an independent news agency based in Japan, and reprised in the Sunday Times of London, North Korean citizens facing starvation have resorted to cannibalism. The Sunday Times piece opened with an anecdote about a North Korean father who was allegedly executed by a firing squad after killing his own two children for food during a famine that struck the country in the past year. The famine has supposedly already taken 10,000 lives this past year in provinces south of the nation's capital, Pyongyang, but has not been reported by international media, much less by the official press of North Korea. Another story coming from mostly unnamed citizen journalists in North Korea's South Hwanghae province said one man dug up the remains of his grandchild and used the corpse for sustenance, while another person who was driven mad by hunger resorted to boiling his own child and eating his flesh. Independent verification of those reports is impossible. And departing from this text, with my own commentary, this could possibly be true. And then again, over the years, I've read many wild stories about North Korea, most of which do not pan out. Returning to the article, from the International Business Times, the extreme food shortage is said to be a result of droughts and crop failures resulting in harsh food rationing. One of the most gruesome stories in the Sunday Times had one man killing his son and daughter while his wife was away and offering the meat to her on her return. It was the wife who ended up turning him into the authorities after growing suspicious about the food. So how bad is it in North Korea? This from Truthout. Criminalizing dissent and punishing the Occupy movement. And it's an article by Mr. Giraud, and very good. An excerpt from his book, and I would like to bring this to you in part and invite your phone calls on the articles that I just mentioned. And any comments that you have on the news you're not supposed to know. And the gist of it is, actually, it's from Henry Giraud's book, Youth in Revolt. He says that Military-style command and control systems are now being established to support zero-tolerance policing and urban surveillance policies designed to exclude failed consumers or undesirable persons from the new enclaves of urban consumption and leisure. That's from an intro by Stephen Graham. You know, actually, before I get to that, I think I want to do just one more topic, and that is the gun control agenda. We'll talk about white males and gun violence. The Second Amendment, as you may be aware, supported the 1789 militias, whose task was to suppress slave revolts, maintain the theft of land from Indian retaliation — those two things took up most of their time when they were operating — and repel British troops from time to time. Once the British troops were gone, it was back to using the guns against people of color. The NRA is a white male organization, and I think no one would doubt that, despite its occasional efforts to cover up. And its gun manufacturer money source knows that white males will pack guns out of fear of black males. Meanwhile, mass murderer psychopaths know that their names will live forever in the corporate-owned press when they do their dirty deed. My answer: use the media to show how pitiful, lonely, and cowardly gun nuts are, encourage rejection of consumer alienation, and the formation of cooperative and interactive communities. But that's saying a mouthful, and it's hard to know where to start when it comes to creating a society in which a small minority of people don't feel that really the only way that they can express themselves is to kill many people or little kids in elementary school. And, of course, the whole thing comes in the context of ignoring the gun violence in oppressed communities and ignoring the fact that when non-whites are killed, it just isn't news. There's an article on this subject in Alternet by Frank Schaefer, and the title is "Gun Control Agenda is Launching White Paranoid Extremists to Prepare for Armed Revolution." And the subtitle is "Peel Back the Code Words of Defending America and You Have a Treasonous Movement in the Works." He writes, "The battle over gun control has exposed the truth the mainstream media is apparently too shy to mention. A bunch of far-right, white, mostly southern, paranoid extremists are preparing for armed revolution and apocalypse. They speak treason literally. They are preparing to, quote, defend, end quote, America from America with arsenals of weapons and stockpiles of ammunition. Their enemy is everyone in America not like them. They think the world is ending and or that the government is out to get them. That doesn't mean that it will happen, but expect violence and assassinations. Their ideology is made up of equal parts racism, evangelical Christian fascination with the end times, hatred of President Obama, resentment of the Old South variety, and a Fox News, Glenn Beck, Rush Limbaugh version of world history. As the New Yorker noted, every demographic and political trend that helped reelect Barack Obama runs counter to the South's self-definition. The solid South speaks less and less for America and more for itself alone. Solidity has always been the South's strength and its weakness. The same Southern lock that once held the Democratic Party now divides the Republican Party from the socially liberal, fiscally immoderate tendencies of the rest of America. The South's vices, violence, intolerance, aversion, and suspicion towards new ideas grow particularly acute during periods when it is marginalized and left behind. An estrangement between the South and the rest of the country would bring out the worst in both. Dangerous insularity in the first, smug self-deception in the second," end quote. Now, time for full disclosure. I own a rifle. It is a bolt-action rifle. I got it because its bullets are so large and so fast that they will actually go through ballistic armor. And I got it as a gesture and mostly empty threat. The threat being that should the situation come about in which squads would be sent out to intimidate dissent, as it has been in so many U.S.-conducted programs around the world in countries where we don't consider the citizens to be very important people, and were members of that squad to go rushing into my house, screaming clear, wearing ballistic armor and helmets, I would probably be able to get off one bullet, which would be so large that it would go through the ballistic vest, so they'd have to worry about that a little bit. In other words, it's kind of an empty gesture. It's not going to get my freedom. It would salve my death a little bit, perhaps. Or maybe I'd be too horrified to pull the trigger. It's hard to say. But I like the threat. And I would encourage everyone who is a dissenter, who has been contacted by the various forms of anti-dissent in this country to take a similar stance. I first bought a weapon in the 1980s when I received a letter from the World Anti-Communist League saying that they were watching me. And of course, I knew who they were, and I think that they knew that I knew who they were and what they did and what they continue to do, as far as I know. So I got that. And so having put all that out on the table, that there is, let's face it, white male and racist edge to the gun debate, and that, on the other hand, there is a reason to have guns in a country whose government is as anti-dissent and violent as this one, I invite your calls, if you dare, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. Returning to the article, as I said, which has been an alternate, and it's by Frank Schaefer, or is it Schaffer? I don't know, actually. I haven't met him. The Republican white Southern extremists make reasonable gun control impossible. Their cataclysmic irrationality risks taking the debate into the twilight zone. And that zone is a zone of violence. Call it the Civil War continued by other means. Some leaders in the pro-gun lobby have literally said they will kill to protect their right to arm themselves with arsenals that are fit for nothing but murder and war. These delusional Americans are a vocal minority, and they have extreme fears: gun confiscation, civil instability, a tyrannical government, a takeover by the U.S., by the U.N., and that Obama is a communist. If you pay attention to the rhetoric, you hear code words calling out to types of people who call January 19th and Martin Luther King's birthday Gun Appreciation Day. The event chairman, Larry Ward, said in the press release, "The Obama administration has shown that it is more than willing to trample the Constitution to impose its dictates upon the American people." Andrew Napolitano, a Fox News analyst, said in a video posted on the network's Greta Wire, "Here's the dirty little secret about the Second Amendment. The Second Amendment was not written in order to protect your right to shoot deer. It was written to protect your right to shoot tyrants if they take over the government," end quote. Wayne LaPierre, chief executive of the National Rifle Association, delivered a rebuttal to President Obama's inaugural address. He accused the president of reducing the U.S. Constitution to a blank slate for anyone's graffiti. LaPierre said that the president doesn't understand you. He doesn't agree with the freedoms you cherish. In a piece in the Washington Times, Napolitano said the Second Amendment protects the right to shoot tyrants, and it protects the right to shoot at them effectively. By definition, these tyrants are those who don't agree with the freedoms you cherish, end quote. In other words, they are the government representing most Americans who are not insane gun-collecting survivalists, southern white males afraid of the world, and assorted Fox News watchers. And departing from the text, of course, the stance I've taken here is that it is southern white males afraid of blacks. That's my opinion. I make that opinion as a result of the historical context that I mentioned earlier and the fact that I come from the South. And I was raised with all that racism bouncing around in my head and spent a lifetime trying to lever it back out. So I know it's there. And I know I'm not exceptional. So, number to call, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187, and Paul's on the air.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
Hey, I want to appreciate your honesty with your comment earlier about how you've chosen to arm yourself. I kind of find myself in a similar situation where I am, for all intents and purposes, a raging socialist, and I do not fit in the Second Amendment crowd. But I've also, I've been in the guns for, you know, a good 12, 13 years, and it's hard. It is hard to have a political view similar to what you and I might share, and also have the contradiction of choosing to arm yourself for protection or recreation or whatever purpose.
Well, you know, once I actually give voice to it, I realize it's not all that difficult. It's just that we haven't had our say in the media. You know, our reason for having a gun is not the same. Certainly,
exactly.
And there's
more of us out there than are there, and I think a lot of us give a little more pause to express our views on that, mainly because within our circles it's more looked down upon. But I take a stance that you do, that, you know, I've chosen to arm myself for certain reasons. It's not to fend off, you know, the New World Order or whatever else that a lot of these other guys try to get into, but just that. I think you and I are more in line with the thinking of, I'd say, the founders, I guess we could say.
It's to, in my case, it's to say there's a limit. I mean, when I got a letter from the World Anti-Communist League, and I think that was 1986, actually. And I went and very openly bought a pistol from a known communist, a very flamboyant communist. I wonder if he's still alive. Walter Birdwell, are you still out there? Oh, my goodness, I wonder. The cars that would pull up and read newspapers, you know, that routine outside of our place, and that would go through the dumpster, went away. They decided that they needed to do something more subtle, which was fine with me.
Well, and that's it. I mean, everybody should be able to make that choice, and that's why I do not support gun control. And from what I find, that in the end, it's, you know, it's just the poor working class guy that's going to get the short end of the stick on the deal, because the wealthy are always going to be able to get what they need to get to defend themselves. People who are out to commit crimes and commit violence are always going to get the means to do so, and it's going to be guys like you and us, or you and I, that are left in the dirt, where, you know, we're not going to go out and try and break the law on something. But at the end of the day, right now, it's, you know, semi-automatic rifles and semi-automatics and high-capacity magazines. But once those are gone, your bolt-action rifle is no longer just a hunting rifle. It becomes a dangerous sniper weapon that is capable of piercing the armor of law enforcement officials who are only just doing their job.
Yeah. Well, they better not do.
It's a slippery slope, and I fear that in the same sense as a dissenter, that, you know, these laws will be applied universally, whereas now, you know, we say, well, you know, it's because we're afraid of these things happening and these mass shootings, and we have to stop these people. But we all know that it doesn't take a semi-automatic rifle with a 30-round magazine to do what happened in Newtown. He could have gone in there with a stick shooter and done the same thing, because there's the mentalities there. It doesn't take, you know, a 30-caliber rifle or whatever to take out a 5-year-old.
Yeah, it's all pretty gross. That brings up the fact that guns are just really ugly things, and they're made for producing grievous puncture wounds in other human beings. So what can you say about it once you know?
Yeah, regardless of what it is. I mean, at the end of the day, it could have been a single-shot, you know, .22 rifle, and it would have accomplished the same thing in the same numbers. It may not be as dramatic, it may not be as scary, or...
I kind of disagree with that. And the reason is... having used both weapons, having a magazine-fed semi-automatic weapon means you just pull the trigger, and having a bolt-action rifle like the one I have means you load a cartridge in there, fire it, you pull the bolt back, you remove the shell, you have to put another shell in it. That gives people an opportunity to take you down, which has happened. Which has affected mass shootings when people needed to reload their magazines, or when the gun jammed. So I can see the logic, really, of not having 100-round magazines. The proposals that are suggested of having 7-round magazines, I think, are perfectly reasonable. I mean, why would you need to fire a thing more than 7 times? It seems to me you'd be in worse trouble than a gun could possibly get you out of if you need to fire all 7 bullets.
I think I look at it more of just the slippery slope angle. First, 10 rounds. No reasonable person needs more than 10 rounds. And we need to do this because this is reasonable, common-sense legislation. And now it's 7 rounds. What comes next? It's that slippery slope where, you know, it, just like with the First Amendment.
Slippery slope doesn't... it's an argument.
It's been done to death, but just for lack of a better word.
Yeah.
But, I mean, look at, you know, we went from, you know, being able to, you know, voice our concerns, march in the streets, and we'd get knocked over the head. But I mean, here we are. We have free speech zones where, you know, they'll set up a cage way off in the distance. Well, you can practice your free speech. You can say whatever you want, but you have to say it over there. And it's just the same thing. And I tie it all in together: First Amendment, Fourth Amendment, Second Amendment. It's just a constant eroding here and there, and all for perfectly reasonable explanations. Well, of course we don't want this to happen because look at this horrible incident, so we need to legislate this. Well, we can't have these people saying this because this happens. And you just can't block the entrance. Why don't you go over there and exercise your rights?
Okay, well, those are good points. I have someone else waiting, so I'll go on to that. And thank you very much for your call. And Phil is next on the air talking about gun violence, and I have framed it as taking place in that historical framework of the racist Second Amendment. Go ahead.
Are you talking to me?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, thank you. the guns aren't dangerous by themselves. It's the people that are on psychotic prescription medications, medications for people that are have various forms of mental illness, which only exacerbate their problem. I've listened to many.
Oh, yeah? In that case, get a double-action six-shooter, please, and fill each cylinder with the hammer down all the way on one cylinder, and then put it where your cat can knock it over and tell me that it's not dangerous.
Yeah. I'm just saying is that people don't go in that aren't... All of the shooters in recent history, the mass shooters, have been at one time or were actually on the prescription medication. And there's really bad side effects while
That's
you're
not
on
true.
It.
That's not first. True that they're all on medication.
What's that?
That's not true that they're all on medication. I remember the first mass shooter in modern history, the
I'm not saying the first one. I'm saying most of the most recent ones are have been on, like, Lexapro or Zoloft or Paxil or what the hell is the old favorite, Prozac, which you guys talked about fluoride before. The main ingredient in Prozac is fluorohexidine gluconate. Look it up in your PDR, your physician's desk reference.
Well, I think that's a good point. I would also argue, though, that one of the main drugs that these shooters are on is white male superiority.
Well, but they're still on the prescription medications. Go look it up, just the facts.
Okay.
But by the way, that anti-communist group, are they still around, and what have they done about Fukushima?
Well, General John Singlob is not around, as far as I know, and I don't think that they would be interested in doing anything about Fukushima, because that's...
Maybe somebody should send them an email or a letter or whatever and ask them, when are they doing constructive?
That's a good point, and if you actually have their address, I would say don't get their attention in any way.
No, I don't... I'm not... pro-communism, that's for sure. I mean, look at the people in North Korea. They're not too happy with it. But unbridled, unfettered capitalism isn't really, I mean, it's just corrupt. I mean, it's just, well, this is the result we've got. We, you know, the bankers have owned our currency since 1913. And
we're kind of getting off topic now, but I really appreciate your call.
They manipulated all this stuff, and they're the big pharma. These are the people that push all these drugs that cause the people to, if they're not goofy already, they're definitely going to be after that, because I've known of people that have never taken prescription drugs and maybe had like a small minor surgical procedure, and most of these people have had the good sense to get off of the drug within 1 or 2 days because it made them so goofy. I mean, one was Paxil, the other one was Zoloft, and I'm the recipient of domestic violence from a lady who was on Prozac and alcohol and became very violent. So it's a violent society, and I don't know if she would have had a gun, what the hell she would have done. But the point is that the prescription drugs are causing these people to go out.
And I do get that point. Thank you very much for that, Phil.
Intelligent people do not go
out. Okay, thanks, Phil, and we'll go on to the next caller. And we'll go to the next caller. Number to call, 503-231-8187. And next caller is Thomas. Hi, Thomas.
Yes, I'll just be brief. Thanks for picking a controversial position, expressing it on this issue. I too, abhor what's commonly called gun violence and the worship of guns and violence, particularly in child's games and things. And our country really is sick. Previous caller has a good point to make about these drugs that were... There's a lot of violence and impulse control. But anyway, the core of it is... Going back to the founding of the Constitution, the reason, now correct me if I'm wrong, that there are amendments, these amendments were added later, and the several amendments were added after there were rebellions by former Revolutionary War soldiers that felt like the British autocracy had been overthrown, and there was a homegrown autocracy that wasn't representing their rights, and there were groups of men with their muskets who marched and tarred and feathered federal judges. And essentially, the amendments, including the First Amendment of free speech, was added by armed militias who were armed with weapons that were equivalent to the weapons of their government.
Now, anyway, that is...
I'll leave with that.
Well, are you still there?
Yes, I'm still here.
That does not... that timeline doesn't quite match. I can see how Shay's Rebellion and the Whiskey Rebellion would affect... subsequent amendments, but the Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments, including the Second Amendment, was appended pretty much immediately.
OK, Okay, well, there were other insurrections and rebellions using militias in support of the right to bear arms. So there is a history. My central point is there is a history in our country of people choosing to bear arms and advocating for that right as a hedge against potential tyranny, and that is cannot be argued.
Well, I think it can be argued, but thanks for your call, and I'll just be looking that up while I take the next call. And hi, Jeremy, you're on the air. Hi, Jeremy. Go ahead. I bet Jeremy is listening to his radio. Now, we have a bit of a delay to comply with the FCC regulations, so that if you say a word that's not on their approved list, then we can punch a little button and the slack gets taken out. And it's a little technical, but that's what we have to do. And that's probably why we're not talking to Jeremy right now. Jeremy, you might have to, we'll put you back in the queue there. And hi, we'll try again. Jeremy, are you there?
Please hang up.
Oh, it's the phone lady. Okay, number to call, 503-231-8187. And there was just a comment about the Bill of Rights. And let's see, the amendments were ratified on December 15th. The first 10 amendments were ratified December 15th, 1791. And if someone wants to be really quick, I think that Whiskey Rebellion and Shays Rebellion were after those points. I could be wrong. So I'm challenging what was asserted before, that the amendments, and particularly the gun amendments, were presented as an effort to allow people to arm themselves against the then-existing government. And my position up to this point, and which I maintain now, is that the Second Amendment has a very racist history to it, that it was created so that people could maintain their long muskets against the indigenous people, the original people here on the continent, whose land they had stolen, against the slaves who they had stolen from Africa, and on a third basis, against British raiding parties. Those were the uses of the militia at that time, and there already was a standing army even before the Constitution was signed. So I don't think that the Second Amendment was intended to be a hedge against the government, although I think that people should dissent openly and freely, and that your hedge against the government is really information. And when push comes to shove, don't worry, if you can make your point, and if you can get the ear of the people who are in the Army, Air Force, Navy, and Marines, and Coast Guard, then we will have them on our side. And I know that from personal experience that to some extent we already do. There are people who have been in the armed forces, maybe not right after you get out of boot camp and you're just getting used to people yelling at you and doing whatever they say. But especially when it comes to special forces and people who have been in the armed forces a long time, there is dissent in the ranks. And if it comes to a revolutionary posture in the United States, I think that's who we're going to have to turn to. And if that is done successfully, then we could have a revolution without any violence at all, which I think would be much preferable. So the number to call, 503-231-8187, and that by way of dealing with the argument that the gun accumulation is necessary on a revolutionary basis. I don't really think so, although you can make some arguments that way. And Michael is on the air. Hi, Michael.
Hi. My name is Michael. I live in Salem, Oregon. Very racist here. People are really into their guns. You go to someone's house, they bring out their gun and show it to you. And I was at the public library. I heard a crowd of people yelling the N-word three times, white power, over and over again. Nobody did anything.
Why, they were just having a little demonstration for white power there?
It was not a licensed, organized demonstration. It was a bunch of thugs in front of the library. So I went across the plaza to the cop shop and told the police about it. And they were so proud of their First Amendment rights that they all scattered when the police came. But yeah, they basically believe that African Americans are all angry about slavery. I have no social life because I've gotten so tired of hearing about Obama's birth certificate and how he wants to destroy Christianity.
Well, now, what part of Salem are you in? Because there's lots of parts of Salem where people are much less reactionary.
Yeah, I was hanging out. I have no social life now, so I'm kind of, you know, looking for other places to hang out. But they're here. I had one person was talking about militias, and he's like, you know, you don't know how many of us there are and stuff, so... I just wanted to confirm there's, you know, that mentality is here. Yeah, I understand it's also, you know, it's a college town in that, too. So, they're, you know, I just started hanging out in one part, kind of like by Kaiser in Salem. And I was kind of hanging out at this bar because I'm curious. And there were interesting people there, I thought. But when I started hanging there, it was like I heard the things they were saying, and I thought they were kind of joking, and then I started realizing these people are serious, and they really think, like you said, they really do believe that the government is out to destroy Christianity, and they, you know, have to fight back. And I don't see how people really could logically think they could have enough guns to fight the United States government anyway, but that's, you know, that's their thing. But I just wanted to confirm there are people out there that, you know, they think that way.
That's true, and the prisons certainly encourage that sort of thing by segregating groups and not eradicating death squad groups like the Klan and the Nazis. Hey, thanks a lot for your call.
All right. Well, thank you. You have a good day. I like KBOO. It's nice to hear.
We can say anything on KBOO.
Yeah. All right.
Isn't that nice? Bye-bye. Okay. 503-231-8187. 503-231-8187. Okay. I want to be the first to admit I was wrong. The Shays Rebellion was January 1787. A militia raised as a private army defeated a Shaysite rebel attempt to seize the federal Springfield Armory. So I was wrong about the date, but it would appear that Shays' Rebellion was put down by a militia. So, and that would be previous to the 1791 Bill of Rights. So the previous caller, I think, was right in saying that those rebellions did affect the amendments. I was wrong, I was wrong, I was wrong. You were right. All right, then. So, the next caller, let me just check with the engineer, is Brent. Number to call, 503-231-8187. Hi, Brent.
Hello there. How are you today?
Doing well. Yourself?
Okay, just fine. Say, on the Second Amendment thing, there's something that people don't realize, or maybe I'm wrong on this, and you can look this up, but there seems to be a preamble to the Bill of Rights. And in the preamble of the Bill of Rights, it's really pretty clear to me that the whole point of the Bill of Rights is for the states to defend themselves against the incursion of the federal government on what the states want to do. Now, that's the way I read it, but I'm not a constitutional lawyer, so I don't really know. So maybe you could elucidate that.
Well, it's back to Lord Google then with the Bill of Rights. And I'm going to use, you know, forgive me, I'm going to use a Wikipedia entry just because we are on the air and I need to move swiftly here. And I just accidentally pressed the button that put me to the page saying U.S. House of Representatives. That's the way it is. I'm using a device that my sister sent me, and I'm really glad to have it right now because my main computer thingy has broken down, so I'm a little clumsy with it. But I think I can pull it up here. Ah, yes, here we go. Let's see if I can find the... let's see. Now, the question about the Bill of Rights, could you restate your question?
Yeah, the question is, to my knowledge, there's a preamble to the
Bill
of Rights.
Okay.
The statement of authority of what the Bill of Rights is all about.
Okay, let me see if I can find something about a preamble. I'll just get... Oh, here we are, 5.1 preamble. Somebody else is probably getting this Wikipedia a lot faster than I am. Let's see if it's listed. So there, we know that there is a preamble, and... let's see if I can find the particular information. I wonder what it will say. Here we are. Congress of the United States. This is the preamble. Congress of the United States begun and held at the City of New York on Wednesday, the 4th of March, 1789. The conventions of the number of the states having at the time of their adopting the Constitution expressed a desire in order to prevent misconstruction or abuse of its powers that further declaratory and restrictive clauses should be added, and as extending the ground of public confidence in the government will best ensure the beneficent ends of its institutions. So you're exactly right about that. Resolved by the state, resolved by the Senate and House of Representatives of the United States of America in Congress, assembled 2/3 of both houses, concurring that the following articles be proposed to the legislatures of the several states as amendments to the Constitution of the United States, all or any of which articles, when ratified by 3/4 of the said legislatures, to be valid to all intents and purposes as part of the said Constitution, viz., articles in addition to an amendment of the Constitution of the United States, yada, yada. It's all, the rest of it is not.
Right. So basically what it's saying is you're agreeing, well, what you just read seems to agree with the way I read it, is that it's for the states, the Bill of Rights.
This is a limit on the federal government.
Was to, yeah, to put limits on the federal government. Now, the disturbing thing about this that I find about the preamble to the Bill of Rights is that, oh, about 10 years ago, I was in the Washington Capitol, and I bought a little booklet on the Constitution, and it went right from the Constitution to the Bill of Rights, and it skipped the preamble. So how are people to understand what the Bill of Rights is about if they leave the preamble
without,
out?
Without that context, well, that's a good point.
And my understanding of the preambles is that they are the statement of authority.
Well, they certainly frame it. I think that's what you want a preamble for.
Well, yeah, but when you say we the people, it's the people of the country saying we are the authority and we're granting these powers to those that govern us.
Right on. Okay, so then back to the gun debate and the Second Amendment. Is there a point that you were then making with that?
Well, yeah. In other words, the whole point behind the Second Amendment was to create a militia for the defense of the states against the incursion of the rights of the states by the federal government.
Oh, no, I disagree with that.
Now, that was, you know, way back then. I'm not saying that we should arm ourselves and march on the federal government, because there's no way you're going to do anything about that.
Okay, here's why I won't accept that. I think that was part of it. But I think that what they actually did, as revealed by previous mention of the militias versus the Shays Rebellion, was put down anything that went against the owning class. And that would be mostly fear of slave rebellion, Indian rebellion, and British troops. But I will concede now, more than I did before, that there is that aspect of keeping the federal government in check.
Oh, I have to agree with you on your points, too.
Okay. All right.
Well, that's my comment.
Okay. Thanks.
Hey, thank you.
Number to call, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. And back to the present day, the point that I'm trying to make is that all of this energy going back to the apartheid, to the slave state, has been carried through to the present day in the form of gun, the form of gun ownership and in the aspect of the white male domination of the whole gun debate. And I do think that without really fully consciously recognizing it, for the most part, certainly there's some exceptions to this, but most of the white males accumulating a large amount of guns are, you know, kind of afraid of black people kind of saying, hey, you know what, this has never been right, and it's time to get what's ours. What do you think of that? Am I tapping into that white male psyche or not? Speaking as a white former male. Number to call, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. Now, I've been remiss in saying that this is KBOO Portland, the only place you can have a debate quite like this in public. And you can get us at kboo.fm. And 90.7 in the greater Portland area and other frequencies elsewhere. And Michael's on the air. Hi, Michael.
Hello. Hello.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm all right. First of all, I'd like to thank you for having this debate on air and allowing your listeners to contact you. I definitely have some strong opinions about this. And
Well, let them fly then.
All right. I've written a few congressmen and my senator, and I did join the NRA in support of anti-gun control legislation, I guess you'd call it, or the passing of gun control legislation. And I guess I got a few points to bring up here. Number one, I really just have this strong sense of being misled by Obama. I did support Obama in the last campaign, and I voted for him, and I did not believe there was going to be any gun control measures, especially of this magnitude, presented in his second term. And while I believe that he has used the media campaign, the mainstream media campaign, surrounding the Sandy Hook shootings and obviously the Colorado movie theater slayings and whatnot, in a media sense to...
Okay, do you think that Obama had the agenda secretly before, and that he's using these incidents as an excuse to control this?
I absolutely believe he had the agenda on the back burner to use as... and if an opportunity came, he would definitely just put that right out there. And I don't really understand why he would do that.
Well, let me just point out, though, that there's never been any talk of confiscating guns.
No, there hasn't. And this is one of your previous callers said it. Nail on the head. He said it's a slippery slope we're on right now because...
Well, and I think we should talk about the slippery slope a little bit, I guess. I mean, one part of it that is not acknowledged, as far as I know, even by the NRA, is that there is gun confiscation on a class and race basis. In other words, the cops come to your home and they're mad at you or don't like you, they'll take your guns, and then you can just try and get it back.
Well, that's
true across the nation. Well, is it really? I mean, because...
Yeah, that's absolutely a separate issue beyond gun control. That's a issue of profiling, whether it be racial profiling or class profiling.
Okay, but that's what I'm saying, is that this whole gun issue takes place in the context of a racist apartheid state, of a Jim Crow state, and we cannot separate the two issues.
Well, exactly, but you're talking about two separate issues here. You're not talking about the Second Amendment right for Americans to own guns, which, you know, I'm 37 years old, and I was taught, you know, in second grade.
Actually, we just spent the last 15 minutes talking about the Second Amendment.
What's that?
We just spent the last 15 minutes talking about the Second Amendment.
Well, just real quickly to reiterate, I was under the impression from all my grade school teachings is that the Second Amendment was put in place to protect us from tyrannical government, and that in itself is one of the staples.
Okay,
that
well,
America.
You know, I appreciate your call, but when you call in without having listened to the previous discussion, what happens is we end up repeating ourselves, and I think that I want to move forward on the discussion on that. So please don't take offense. I think I'll go on to the next caller. 503-231-8187. 503-231-8187, and Gary is on the air.
Hi, Teresa. This is Gary. I'd like to go back a little further in history to the Stono Rebellion of 1739, and what this was. This was the reason why the militias were formed. They were formed in order for the white plantation owners to protect themselves against the slaves themselves, because it was the slaves who rebelled.
How do you spell that?
Stono.
Okay.
Stono River Rebellion. And I guess I'll take my answer off the air after you've read up on this, but this was the reason they formed the militia, okay? This is why they put this in the Second Amendment. It's pre-history of the Shea Rebellion. Check it out.
That is very interesting. Okay, I will check it out as best I can. Here we are, Stono Rebellion. Once again, I'll go to afroamericanhistoryabout.com, and it's also in Wikipedia if you want to look that up. And let's see what comes up here in print too tiny for a 54-year-old to read. It says, the Stono Rebellion. Oh, come back here. I'm not used to these devices.
Stono River Rebellion.
Stono Rebellion. Ah, there we are. Was the largest rebellion mounted by slaves against the slave owners in colonial America. The Stono Rebellion's location was near the Stono River in South Carolina. The details of the 1739 event are uncertain, as documentation for the incident comes from only one first-hand report and several second-hand. White Carolinians wrote these records, and historians have had to reconstruct the causes of the Stono River Rebellion and the motives of the slaves participating from these biased descriptions. Of course, we can guess what the motives of the slaves were. Not to be slaves! On September 9th, 1739, early on a Sunday morning, a group of around 20 slaves rendezvoused at a spot near the Stono River. They had pre-planned their rebellion for this day, stopping first at a firearms shop. They killed the owner and supplied themselves with guns.
Yes, they actually put the head, they cut off their heads and put them on spit trucks out of the gun shop.
I just love it that they stopped at a firearm shop first. And that was actually, that's a point that I wanted to make.
A lot of these, about... blacks who rebelled actually fought in previous wars in Spain and so forth, so they knew about the military, which is one reason why the whites were worried about them, because they actually did know how to fight.
Well,
read further on.
Yeah,
it.
Yeah, I think I will. Okay, that's very interesting. I really appreciate you bringing that up.
This will answer your questions on the militia.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that it does.
It makes
the point that I was trying to get out there just from the context, and I didn't know the context well enough, and it's great to get some details. Thanks for that. Number to call, 503-231-8187. It brought up another point that I wanted to make, and that is, if I were really interested in violent rebellion, and I'm not, I mean, my trajectory towards dissent is as follows. I would like to rile up the public with the truth so much that at some point we can say we want another government. And if there is violent objection to that from the powers that be, I think that we can assume that there would be, that we will convince so much of the armed forces to be on our side that we can transfer power without violence. And failing that, then you get into the whole moral question of the ugliness of violence and getting what you want by hurting somebody else. I'm not as sure. I'm not as sure either way. I'm going to put it that way. I think there have been many perfectly legitimate violent rebellions, and I support them, and I think that the karma that you generate doing that sort of thing is horrible. And having said all that, I just forgot the name of the next person who's in the queue. Tori, thank you. I have a great engineer.
Okay. First, I just wanted to thank you for having this debate on the air. And I just wanted to make a quick comment, which is, well, also full disclosure, I don't necessarily agree with the pro-Second Amendment folks, but I just wanted to make a comment, which is that I think that from the way the conversation has been going so far today, I think that we haven't been as respectful to people who do have those opinions as we could be by saying things like, you know, that they're repeating themselves. I think that they're maybe repeating themselves because there is, you know, a group of people who do feel strongly about sort of their founding, you know, father's beliefs. And although I don't agree with them, I think that it's fair to hear them out.
Oh, yes, I quite agree.
Yeah, so I just wanted to remind us all that, we should be respectful of a broad spectrum of opinions.
Right on.
That's all.
I like that.
Okay.
Okay, thanks for your call. Number to call, 503-231-8187. And elaborating further on the point I was making after I read that the Stono Rebellion blacks got their guns from a gun shop, is that, you know, should it come to needing a weapon, well, there's an AR-15 in the trunk of every cop car. And if you really want to talk horrible, bloody violence, well, I've got a skillet. I suppose I could go brain a cop and get his gun. If he doesn't know it's coming, you know, when you talk about rebellion, those, and then on the other hand, you know, the U.S. armed forces can certainly tell you that when they go into a population that is heavily armed with everything from pistols to rifles, they have a hell of a time getting their way. So I also don't agree with the argument that guns are useless in preventing government tyranny, but I think that depends on how they are organized, how they're used, and certainly Che Guevara and Fidel Castro could give a few pointers on using what arms you have to best advantage to get better arms. All of that goes into the whole projection of armed rebellion, which, as I said, I'm not supporting. And yet, it's part of the argument. The gun argument has gotten pretty complex, and my point is there are still many points that just haven't really been explored, and these guns have a place in our psyche that we have. These guns have a really complex place in our national psyche. And that's one of the points I would like to make. So going on to the next caller. Hi, you're on the air.
Hey, Teresa.
Hi.
Good to talk to you.
Thanks.
I just wanted to get back to your question. You were wondering if the militia types in the U.S. were you know, afraid of the colored population.
Yeah.
And I agree with that, but I think you're limiting their scope. They're afraid of everybody. I'm not just speaking out my tutor here, because I happen to be a pagan Hindu anarchy loving tribal socialist of the redneck clan.
Uh-huh.
I have lots of cousins out there that think like this, and basically speaking, that they are preparing for the end times. You know, I mean, and if you think about it, what was that military exercise? I don't know, a month and a half ago, where the military actually did a drill preparing for the zombie apocalypse.
And now that I haven't heard about. I made a joke about that the other day. I was driving a bus, and I was looking in the back of the bus. It was late at night, and the people who were driving it were so pitiful, I thought, oh, my God, the zombie apocalypse has definitely begun.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and that word zombie, that word is used to describe the masses of hungry people when we run out of diesel fuel, because what would it take, about a week for the Safeway store to run dry? If there was, you know, if we had a diesel fuel shortage all of a sudden, that kind of thing.
I think in a sort of way of dream metaphor, I think you're right on.
Anyway, that's all I had. So I love your show. Bye-bye.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, the collectively expressed dream metaphor of the zombie apocalypse. Isn't that really just poor, hungry, diseased people coming to get what's yours? Well, we don't have much time left, but I think we do have another caller or two. And so we'll just try to get your opinion out there. Using 25,000 watts talking to 40,000 people is Austin. Hi, Austin.
Hi there. Thanks for having my call. I just had a quick comment. For all the people who want to think back to their second grade education, a lot of the things that were taught is that, such as Christopher Columbus was this hero who went and found the new world and brought back riches for everybody. And as we know now, that is not the truth or the entire truth at all.
Yeah, that's sort of like a home invasion person. That's, you know, he could discover your place.
Yeah, exactly. So, like, you know, it's time now to do what we're doing now and re-educate ourselves on the actual facts of history and re-educate ourselves on what, you know, the truth, like we're doing now. And so I just want to say that, and also thank you for having this debate, and thank you to all.
You're welcome, and it's really fun to have a debate like this with, well, not so much a debate, but as just a talk with the KBOO audience, because it's different, and it's much more complex and beautiful, and thanks for your call. Number to call, 503-231-8187. Well, actually, I don't need to get that number out anymore, because I'm almost out of time. Real quickly, let's see. You've got about 30 seconds, and we'll see if that's actually going to come through. Oh, okay, people have already decided it's the top of the hour. Well, they're right. It's the top of the hour, and pretty soon, you'll be able to listen to Chris Andre and her news broadcast. And then let's see, I think that's followed by Flashpoints. So we've got some excellent public affairs coming right up here on your people-supported free radio station, KBOO Portland.
And once again, you're listening to KBOO Portland. Air Cascadia is next. Then at 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio. At 11 today, the film show presents a special hour-long preview of upcoming winter film festivals, including the Portland Black Film Festival, the Cascade Festival of African Films, and of course, the Portland International Film Festival. Coming up next, it is Headlines, Interviews, and Commentary with Air Cascadia.
KBOO Radio is a proud media sponsor of Winterfolk, Portland's largest annual folk music event and a benefit for Sisters of the Road. Winterfolk will celebrate their 25th anniversary on February 2nd at 7 p.m. at the Aladdin Theater, 3017 Southeast Milwaukee, and features Peter Yarrow from Peter, Paul, and Mary, The Rite of Spring, Beth Wood, Sky in the Road, and many more. Again, that's Winterfolk, Saturday, February 2nd at the Aladdin Theater in Portland. A benefit for Sisters of the Road. More information can be found at kboo.fm/winterfolk2013. KABU is a proud media sponsor of the Fertile Ground Festival of New Works, presented by the Portland Area Theater Alliance from January 24th through February 3rd. Fertile Ground features 88 events with over 50 artists and companies, including Artists Repertory Theater, Portland Playhouse, and Polaris Dance, and dozens more. For a 10-day festival pass or ticket info, visit fertilegroundpdx.org or go to kabu.fm.
Good morning, Cascadia. Today is Thursday, January 31st, 2013, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM, KBOO.FM on the web. Now that Americans in general seem to rely on emotions rather than intellect when making decisions, the Mohamud family must be wondering what's going on in the minds of the jury deciding their son's fate. And from this, from the Whoops, We Did It Again department, as Chuck Hagel is being eviscerated by domestic Zionists, meanwhile, Israel has gone and bombed Syria, a sworn ally of Iran's. We'll see what comes out of that. Nothing good, I suspect. First, the weather. Today, patchy morning fog, cloudy most of the day, 50-50 as far as rain is concerned. Highs around 50 with a light wind. And tonight, overcast, foggy, lows around 40, much colder in outlying areas, light wind driving it all. And for tomorrow, overcast morning, clearing a bit, areas of fog and highs around 50 for tomorrow night. Overcast skies with a low around 35. The alternative forecast, we've got a waning gibbous moon in Virgo, root moon, 19 days old, a cyanotic outlook. Now is a good time for root vegetables, various bulbs, onions. And the biodynamic forecast moon in Virgo, it's an earth sign, so you want to go for root plants. And there's a note here. You know, it's easy to carry around a clove of garlic, a bundle of garlic. You to pull off each one of those little cloves if you see a bare spot and just poke it in the ground. You never know. Garlic, of course, will come up at some point in the future, and some lucky person will find it. It's guerrilla gardening, and it's open to anyone. No excuses not to grow something. The sidereal forecast moon in Virgo, dry and barren, so plenty of time to get the garden maintenance underway for spring. That said, moving straight into it, news from